Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today, I have Avi Mayer of Travel Perk coming to us from Barcelona. How's it going?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Avi just mentioned they're having thunderstorms in Barcelona. Yeah. So hopefully we'll get some good, exciting.
This is not what they promised when I moved here. You know, they promised sun and beach, you know, and now we have a thunderstorm.
Where are you from originally?
I'm from Israel, from Tel Aviv.
I would have guessed that. That's awesome. And did you move there? What led you to Barcelona?
So I actually moved here for business school and kind of decided to stick around. It's an amazing city and kind of has a really nice balance of, professional opportunities, but also great quality of life. So, you know, my wife and I just decided to stay here. And actually our two kids were born here. So I guess we are really kind of a part of the community now.
That's great. That's cool. I've been there years ago, not since I was in college, which feels like forever ago. But yeah, it was a fun town for sure.
It changed a lot. I haven't been here before, but before we moved here 9 years ago, but apparently it was a completely different city and they reinvented the city, in a way. So super interesting. It's a startup by itself, right? I mean, that's interesting.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. All right. Well, I do want to talk about kind of the Barcelona startup scene and funding scene, but let's actually just start off with what Travel Perk does. What do you guys do?
We fix business travel. So business travel is a $1.5 trillion industry globally, and it's really not working the way it should. So, you know, the two categories that companies have when they have to choose a way to send their employees around the world for business, these two categories do not work. So the first category, we're talking about using a travel agent, the American Express of the world. And I always, when I speak on stage, I always ask people, when was the last time anybody here used a travel agent for vacation, right? And unless you go on a very kind of niche, like a safari trip somewhere, people don't need a physical travel agent anymore. They can, it sounds obvious, right? But you book online. So why is it that we as companies ask our travelers to use travel agents? It's clunky, it's expensive, they charge high fees because they are service-based companies rather than product or technology-based companies. They have limited inventory, so it just doesn't work, right? And then that's category number one. And then the second category is giving up and saying, just go and book anywhere you want, right? This is called unmanaged, and that's 60% of this $1.5 trillion I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And unmanaged is, by definition, you get access to good inventory because you have the entire internet at your hands, but then you waste time comparing 12 websites on average, and you lose oversight as a CFO of the company on knowing what people spend and why and what were the other options, right? So you really have to choose between two bad categories. And we looked at it and happy to kind of expand on our background as a founding team, but we come from booking.com before, so from the consumer side of travel. Gotcha. And we thought to ourselves, why can't business travel behave like consumer travel, like leisure travel? And that's what we're trying to do, fix it in a consumer way.
Interesting. And is it a markup on the cost of the travel, or is it a more of a subscription model, or what's the business model?
Yeah, so we actually have the same business model as leisure travel websites, meaning that we are getting a commission from the supplier, mainly from accommodation, right? Hotels pay a commission, and we're getting a piece of that. It's not a markup, it's just a part of what you pay. Let's say you pay $100 a night to the hotel, I'm getting some of that as revenue. That's the main revenue stream. We also have premium and enterprise accounts where we have guaranteed SLA and better easier payment terms. So basically companies pay at the end of the month against an invoice, get credit from us, and then we charge for that on a per trip basis.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. And is it just in Europe now? You guys are based in Spain, or are you global?
Yeah, we are global minded, and we have customers in practically every continent of the world. We are focused on Europe at the moment and kind of opening offices now in London and Berlin to expand within Europe. But by the nature of the beast, really, this is travel, right? And even European companies travel a lot outside of Europe. So you have to be everywhere. You have to have a solution that works globally.
Yeah, cool. So I wanted to get to the backstory or the genesis story. You kind of touched on that already. You guys were a couple founders from booking.com, and that was a, was that one of the kind of like the Orbitz or the, was that in the same category of do it yourself, you know, price comparison or was it something different?
Yeah, no. So we actually, so I had a startup before called Hotel Ninjas, which we did software for hotel management, and we sold that to booking.com. Booking.com is really kind of today the largest online travel agency for accommodation, right? So they're selling millions and millions of transactions every day, and they're part of the Booking Holding Group, which used to be called the Priceline Group. So it's the same same group as Priceline, Kayak, OpenTable, Rentalcars.com, so a few other companies within online travel on the consumer side.
Gotcha, gotcha. Yeah. So with Hotel Ninjas, did you raise money for that, or did you bootstrap that to your exit?
Yeah, we bootstrapped, and it was a very small business at the time of the acquisition.
Interesting, cool. Okay, great. So let's talk about raising money. It looks like you guys have raised quite a few rounds. Maybe give me just a summary of how many rounds and how much you guys have raised.
Oh, geez, like, I don't know, many rounds. It feels a lot. It feels like a lot. Yeah, we raised a seed round, an A, B, and C, right? So these are four rounds.
Gotcha, yeah. And when did you guys start? So how long has this been in business?
We started 2015. We pivoted in 2015. So we raised a seed, $1.5 million seed, early 2015. We invested our own money there. So with $300K of our own money, and the rest came from angel investors. And then we pivoted, and after the pivot, we raised the following rounds.
Let's just go a little deeper into each one. So the angel round, was that Spanish angels? Were these Israeli angels? Were these just people you knew around the globe? What was the makeup?
Yeah, so actually, we didn't have any Spanish investor, and that's a little bit, they're great investors in Spain, but we really had global ambitions day one, and we didn't want to be number one in Spain. We keep saying that we are a global company that happens to be in Barcelona, because why not? But we don't see ourselves, we don't have any focus in Spain, not in customers, not in employees. We are, you know, English is the official language in the office here, and 80% of the workforce is from outside of Spain. So it just made more sense to raise from investors that have this kind of more kind of global state of mind.
So, okay. So you had global ambitions from the beginning. So how did you put together this angel round? Where did the people?
Yeah, it was a pretty usual friends and family. I hope we didn't have the third F, you know, the fools. Mm-hmm. We are very smart investors. So friends and family, these are, you know, mainly business connections, and then we did have one early stage VC also in the angel round. So we had a fund called Local Globe out of London, and it's run by it was founded by Sol and Robin Klein, who were partners at Index. One of the they were the first partners at Index in London, and they left Index to create this new fund called Local Globe, and we were very fortunate to have them early on. We actually, I think, the first investment they did out of the fund.
Okay.
So, yeah, so they took most of the rounds, you know, the angel round, and then the rest was mostly, you know, small tickets from friends and family.
And did you have a product in the market at that point, or was this pre-product?
No. It was pre-product, yeah. We had a presentation.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Not a good one, even.
Then let's go to the Series A. It looks like that was about an $8 million Series A, and I see some of these names. Some of these names I recognize: Spark Capital, Felix.
Yeah.
Who led your Series A, and any stories about putting that together?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting one. So Spark led the A. Felix actually joined in the B. So the A was Spark and Sunstone. Sunstone is a VC here in Europe, based in Berlin and Copenhagen. So the story of the A is actually interesting, and I think it's probably one of, hopefully one of the first learning points that your listeners can have from our story, in that we didn't do a proper round, right? We didn't go and do a roadshow and we didn't pitch it. The way it worked is we have a very close advisor to the business, a guy called Johannes Reck, who is the CEO of a very successful company called Get Your Guide here in Europe, out of Berlin. Johannes started as an advisor. Now he's actually a board member and invested also. And one of the first things that he told me is, don't stick with investors. You have enough money. We had just raised 1.5 million. Focus on building a product, focus on building an MVP and getting the first customers, which was a great advice. So I listened to him. And then one day he calls me and says, hey, Avi, I told you not to speak with investors, but you have to speak with this guy. And I'm like, okay, I'll speak with him. And the guy was Alex Finkelstein from Spark in Boston. So Alex and I speak. We connect really well. It was a video call. And then he says, do you mind if I come over next week? And I'm like, well, do you have a trip planned? Or like, no, I want to meet you. So, okay, that's interesting. And Alex is a senior partner at Spark, right? So he's when a GP flies over from Boston to Barcelona, you know, this means business, right? So we took it very seriously, obviously. We spent the day with Alex, my co-founder and I. We didn't have a product at it, a very basic product, I would say. So it was mainly around getting to know each other as individuals, right? That was kind of the main point. And I remember walking, it wasn't today's a rainy day here in Barcelona, unusually, as I said, but it was April in Barcelona, which is very nice and sunny. So we were walking down the beach by the ocean and just talking about our vision for the company. Where do we think we should go? How big it can be? And during this walk, and a few beers were involved as well. and then he said, how about you come to Boston next week and we'll give you a term sheet? And I was like, I couldn't believe it, right? It sounded too cruel. Spark is a great fund. I mean, look at the success story they had. It's amazing. I mean, I should probably not mention too many portfolio companies, but I don't want to offend everybody else, but Twitter was an early stage investment for them when they had only a handful of people there. They invested in Cruise that was sold to to GM for over $1 billion only 8 months after they invested. So the A round, so really great portfolio of companies, Trello, you know, Stack Exchange, et cetera. So, you know, they're A player VC and kind of getting invited to go to Boston and pitch the partnership was a really great opportunity.
So what do you think was it that, I mean, cause that almost sounds too good to be true, right? This guy talks to you on Skype or whatever, and then comes over and you guys are walking down the beach drinking beers and, you know, that leads to a term sheet. What do you think it was it that, did he have a thesis about the travel space and he identified you? Like, how did this actually happen?
So first, yes, I mean, Alex is a very smart travel investor. He invests in other verticals as well, but he has a few great investments, including at least one unicorn that he invested in the early stage, Get Your Guide. So he's a very experienced and smart travel investor. I think, and I spoke with him about it, so I have some notion of what he had in mind. And basically the way he looked at it was, if you assess all the risks that there is in an investment, you could have a product risk or a market risk or a team risk or, you know, whatnot. We had an interesting idea of a product, the initial product, right? So yes, of course there is a risk and we scale the product and we build the next version. That's some kind of risk, but we show that we can build at least the first version and get people to use it, right? At the time, I think we had probably maybe 10 customers, 10 companies using us, something like that. Today we're at 1500, just kind of to give you the order of magnitude. We had around 10 companies probably using us, maybe less. So MVP with an initial product market, not really product market, but initial usage, let's say. So the product risk was minimal, according to him. The market is huge. We're talking about $1.5 billion. So there is no question about the market. People will travel for work in the foreseeable future, unless Elon Musk comes with like teletransportation or whatever technology that kills air and hotel industries. This is here to stay, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you look at all the risks, you know, product, market, competition, et cetera, et cetera, the only real risk that we had at the time, and we still, you know, to a certain extent, we still have today, is execution, right? And that's an interesting risk to have because it depends on you, right? It's about the quality of the team and about the quality of execution and strategy. And it just like that, you like that it's a very clear proposition, solving a real pain point. Travel, nobody likes the way they travel for work.
Yeah.
So solving a real pain in a huge market. I think, you know, a great team that we had already then, and for sure the kind of team we have now. So he saw all of that, and he was like, that's interesting. And that's kind of deals that VCs are dying to find.
Yeah, yeah, and that's good. Yeah, and this actually syncs up a little bit with a similar interview I had yesterday that, you know, it was a big market, a team that had done things before, and again, kind of execution risk, but some proof of concept, and that seemed to be a good sweet spot for these investors. They were very different story. They were making e-commerce platform for plus size women, but the team had been in fashion together at Gilt Group. They had a big market, you know, hundreds of millions of women, and that was enough for the investors. All right, so that was a Series A, and then from there, was it just building products, scaling, and, you know, progressively raising more? Or how did you know when to raise the next round?
So we actually, it's a good question. The thing is, our B and the C looked kind of like the A, in a sense that we got an introduction to an investor. We were not at each of the rounds. We were not actually, at that time, we were not looking to raise.
Yeah.
At least not very actively, like always open to speaking with people, but never, like we never actively kind of went there and did a roadshow. And almost the same story, actually, just meeting great investors, seeing that we have the same ambition and vision about the product and about the market. And then just the deals kind of shaped out of that.
Was it, you know, like in the Series A, you had Johannes sort of as the catalyst or initiating this to the introduction to Alex Finkelstein. At the B and C, was it Alex saying, hey, let me connect you to a couple guys. I think you guys are ready to talk to them. Or was there some other catalyst?
Yeah, it's always introductions. Yeah. I mean, and this is, I think, very important also to note. I mean, it was always intros from, you know, people from the network, right? So if I'm not mistaken, the B, so we have two colleagues in the B. I think one of them was actually Johannes again, and the other one was Local Globe, our angel round investor or seed round investors. And then for the C, it was also another introduction from an existing investor. So always intros was kind of the catalyst for the beginning of the conversation with the lead investor.
Did you ever run a process and really get out and shop the deal around, or was it
no.
a couple introductions, term sheet, and get back to business?
It's actually a bit unusual, but we never pitched it to more than in any given round. We never pitched it to more like three funds.
Mm. Interesting. This is a different strategy than most of the folks I've talked to. Do you ever feel like you didn't go on enough dates with investors if you only talk to three funds per round, or did you just have a good feeling about the ones you did talk to? Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I'm lazy. I mean, you always have the thought that, you know, maybe I could have gotten like 10% higher valuation, but I think it's also very important to make sure that you have a strong fit with the investor. So it's not only about valuation, because it's a partnership. It's the partnership that you just cannot unwind, right? I mean, if you think about partnerships, like business partnerships or even, you know, marriages, there are ways out, right? You know, and this is the one that you look at an SPA, and there isn't a way out. You cannot ask the investor to step down and take his money and go away, right? It just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So I think this, the cultural fit or the ambition and how we see the business, values, right? Your values as a person and their values as people. I think all of it is extremely important, maybe, you know, probably more important than valuation within a range of reason, right? But
maybe touch on that, because I think that's interesting. So, you know, a lot of these calls will talk about almost building the funnel and how people did that. You didn't have to do so much work on building the funnel. So how did you sort of map your business values, or what sort of business values were you really trying to optimize for?
I approach it the same way I approach hiring, right? So I interviewed the investors the way I interview candidates, right? And you ask exactly the same way. So you ask them, and then you ask them to give you an example and through stories, through examples, through reference calls about them, right? Which is also very important, both for candidates for you know, to join the company, and also for investors. And I think that's something that entrepreneurs are always very shy about, about due diligence on your investors. And I don't think we should be, right? I mean, mm-hmm. we are, let's not forget that in the equation of raising money, we are the ones who are deciding who to buy from. We are buying cash, right? And we're selling equity. And if you have a good company and you're able to raise and you're able to get term sheets, if you can get one term sheet, you get two and three and four. So it's up to you to decide who to buy from, and you have to do your diligence. Like, you cannot just go into a partnership without knowing who we're talking to. So I just interview them like the way I interview candidates, and then I do reference calls and we regroup as a team and talk about the investor and try to assess if they're the right fit for us.
Do you have one or two interview questions that you are your favorite or that you find really uncover kind of like, you know, good stuff?
Yeah. So I think there is one that is very, it's great for all kind of interviews. And basically like asking about failure and how they had handled failure, right? So do you have an example of when you failed and what you learned from it and how you approach that? So, but because I'm trying to assess companies, you know, especially startups will go through, you know, good times and bad times. And I'm trying to assess how this person will react if we have a quarter of missed, you know, growth or something, you know, we lose an important team member with the company. So I'm trying to assess that. And also specifically for investors, so that's kind of a more general question. And then specific for investors, I have a very strong, we as a team have a very strong, you know, willingness to create a big independent company here. And just asking straight, I mean, what if we get an offer to sell the company for $400 million, right? Mm. So what should we do? And to make it more precise, I'm talking about like in the next 12 months, right? So imagine if somebody just invested in a much, much, much lower valuation than that, and tell them exit in 12 months, $400 million, what should we do? And mm-hmm. and I want to see if they are in it for the long term like we are, right? So the obvious answer it should be hell no, right? You know, why would you sell for 400 if you can create a $100 billion company? So just, it's a no-brainer.
Interesting. So you're using that to gauge whether they'd be in it for the long term. I can see other founders using a question like that to gauge whether the investor would maybe block an exit, you know, because this is one of these like conflicts.
But I wanted to block an exit, right? In this size, right? So that's actually something very important for us. I want to have around, especially in the board, but also, you know, investors that are not on board, I want them to push me to say no, because it will be, I mean, we shouldn't kind of fool ourselves, right? I mean, as a founder, especially in early stage, getting an offer to sell your company for $400 million, this is a life-changing amount of money that we're talking about.
Right.
My grandchildren will never have to work again. And this is Spain, so this is a lot of money, right? So, yeah. So it's actually the other way around. I want them to block us. I want them to be, to really put up a fight. If I, because it will be tough for anybody to say no to this kind of money, right? And I want them to be there and say, what are you talking about? You know, didn't you say that you're going to build a multi-billion-dollar business? Why are we talking about selling for $400 million, right? So it's actually by design that I want them to be like this.
But, you know, just to kind of like play devil's advocate, I mean, there are, that's all great if things continue to go up and to the right and everything goes well. But when things maybe you miss a quarter, a couple quarters, and then you've got to raise more money, it's usually the founder that suffers the dilution and the protective provisions, and the VCs are protected because of the term. So, yeah. I mean, does that factor into your kind of, this is a, more of a bigger question, but yeah. Any thoughts on that?
We are not in a safe line of business, right? If I wanted safe, I would go to work in a bank. Actually, not anymore, right? Even banks are not safe.
Right.
So no, I mean, this is a risk, right? And you have to factor it in, and we definitely, I definitely have it in mind, right? I mean, if we have a down round scenario, I will get diluted a lot, right? This is something that is part of the game. As long as you understand the rules of the game, I think it's fine. The issue is if sometimes you don't understand that.
Yeah.
So yeah, of course, that's a risk, completely.
Okay, good. couple other questions here. I notice I'm looking at like your, if Pitch Book is correct, you did the Series B in May of 2018, then a Series C in October of 2018. So it looks like the fundraising's kind of gotten faster between rounds. I mean, are you, I guess, any strategy on that? Are you in a market? Do you have a lot of competitors? Is this like a horse race to gain market share? Or is there any deeper?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a great question. Yes, the thing is, business travel, the whole market is now transforming and moving from, it's a $1.5 trillion beast that kind of woke up, you know, and like, mm-hmm. you know, and then the opportunity that almost didn't exist 5 years ago now is so clear. And the way we see it is we are now in 2005, right? This is the year where so many things moved around leisure travel. You know, booking.com got acquired, and then Expedia, there was a spin-off a few years before that of Expedia. To, you know, so all of these kind of changes in leisure travel that ended up with three big players, you know, namely Booking Holding Group, Expedia Group, and now Airbnb is obviously growing very, very nicely. And of course, more smaller players. And this is what is about to happen in business travel. So we're going to see in the next 10, 15 years, probably two or three groups that will dominate business travel. And will be, you don't have a $100 billion company in business travel, you do have in leisure travel. You know, Booking Holding is now run roughly $100 billion in market valuation. Expedia is more than that, but still, you know, it's a very big business. And the same is about to happen in business travel. So this is what everybody's realizing now. And those like us that have a three-year, almost 4 years now, you know, head start against everybody else, then of course, this is the reason why we're raising, are able to raise more money, plus our growth rate, plus our vision about things. And the idea is this is a land grab. And a lot of companies that are not using any business travel tool today will be using something in the next 5 years, right? And this something should be travel perks. So this is what kind of we're going for. And that's hence the importance of going fast. And yeah, you need to raise more money to go even faster.
Yeah. It looks like Spark is in the US, but a lot of the investors are European. I noticed like you had DST, which is Yuri Milner's fund, right? He's kind of an interesting personality. What was it like pitching him? How'd you get connected with those guys?
So to be precise, this is Yuri and his partner Tom investing personally. This is not DST.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, their checkbook doesn't contain checks small enough to fit our mini $44 million round. It's too small. So we know Tom. Tom is Tom Stafford is based in London. So we know him through again introductions, and he was the one who introduced us to Yuri. It was probably one of the most interesting and intense pitches I've ever done in my life. Yuri is I don't know if you know, but he's actually a scientist by training, and is also extremely smart and very interesting guy. And it was a longer than the average pitch, and we almost didn't talk about the business. We talked about, and this is what he was trying to do, and that's why I liked it so much, because he was trying to assess me as a person. And I was trying to assess him as a person. So I think at the end of the conversation, we realized that we just like each other as people, and we decided to do business together.
Interesting. Would you, just for kicks, do you remember one of the topics you guys talked about? Was it probably not?
I think the main one was ambition, right? And kind of what's your goal? And you know, Yuri and I shared the same belief that the kind of work-life balance is kind of a bit of a misconcept. If you really want to build a huge business, you really have to dedicate your life to it. And I think this is something that both him and I see eye to eye on this topic.
Good segue. I wanted to talk about building a startup in Spain and raising money in Spain. And almost it was seemed contrary to what you just said about you know, ambition and everything to build it in Spain, right? Because I think of Spain as your holiday destination. What's it, I guess, why are you in Spain and what's it like, what's the startup scene like in Spain?
Yeah, so I'm in Spain because I moved here for business school and kind of my wife said that we're staying here and I listened to my wife. So that's why we're here. and it's a great decision. Yeah. Learned that very, very young actually. And it's a great destination to actually for talent, right? So this is one of the hacks that we have in Barcelona, that we are able to relocate people from anywhere in the world. We have people here who move from the Valley. We have people who move from any place in Europe. We have people who move from the Middle East, from Asia. And it's just a very easy destination to move to, especially when you're young and kind of are interested in doing like a 2 to 4 year adventure and maybe stay and maybe not, right? So we have a lot of smart people that moved here for that venture. And the startup scene is actually is becoming really interesting. So it was kind of non-existent. There are a few early success stories, which were basically national champions in Spain. Privalia is a famous one. It's an e-commerce, a fashion e-commerce website.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Acquired by Vente Privée. Trovit, Budget Places. We had a few online successes. All of them, Social Point is another one. It's a gaming company. All of them in the range. So relative to Europe, it's a nice success. Talking about range of, you know, $80 to $400 million exits. So these are nice ranges for Europe. They're not as impressive for the Valley, you know. And that was kind of the previous generation. And now you have a new generation of startups that is more global and less thinking about Spain as the core market.
Mm-hmm.
And just to name a few, I mean, Buddies is a great startup here. They're helping. It's an app to help people find roommates.
Okay.
Created by extremely smart young entrepreneur. Glovo is another one. It's an everything delivery app, doing amazingly well. They just closed, I think, another round of more than $100 million raised. And expanding extremely fast to South America as well as I think Africa. They mentioned last time in a press release. So yeah, a few of these. It's not as vibrant as the Valley for sure. It's not as vibrant as Tel Aviv or even Berlin yet. But it's definitely up and coming. It's definitely beginning now. For a new generation.
Is the startup scene concentrated in Barcelona or Madrid, or is it spread around?
So you have Madrid and Barcelona, two hubs. Barcelona has more direct investments, so more VC money flowing into it from especially for foreign investors or non-Spanish investors. And I think by just absolute number of startups, Barcelona has more than Madrid, but definitely Madrid has a few interesting startups as well. So these are the two hubs that exist in Spain. There is one company in Valencia that I know of, right? So Flywire is in half Valencia, half in Boston. And then the rest of the cities are more holidays destination rather than kind of startup destinations.
You mentioned, I think this was kind of fun, the hack is to, you know, get people to move to Barcelona. Can you recruit there? And what's the talent pool like? And what's the work ethic like of local talent?
Yeah, so local talent exists. Hiring great people, especially engineers, designers, but also all roles basically, is never easy. I don't think it's easy in any place in the world to hire great people, and for the great talent everybody's fighting for. As I said, we do have some competition in terms of other startups and also bigger companies. Local talent is great. You have a young generation of engineers and designers and product owners that have traveled, that have worked abroad, and came back with these notions of thinking about a startup in the right way, I would say. Not as a lifestyle business, but really as kind of scaling a business to very big size.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it we're doing the education ourselves, for sure. And actually, we don't have any issue around work ethics. I think it's more of maybe outside of the big cities. I'm not Spanish, so I don't know exactly if it's a true stereotype or just a stereotype, but I don't see it in Barcelona that much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, great. Any tips for any Spanish startups that are, up and coming, maybe, at the early stages, raising seed, series A, just to navigate the scene? Is there any groups or resources?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say start global day one, think big. Don't try to be number one in Spain. Try to be number one, at least in Europe, if not globally. And don't be afraid to be ambitious. I think there's a lot of kind of shyness. I think something that everybody can learn from Americans, especially from the Valley, is being extremely bold with statements, even in the early days. People start, there are three people in a garage and they talk about being number one in something, globally. Mm-hmm. right? And I think this kind of ambition is crucial to create your startup. You cannot be anything less than that in your ambition.
Yeah, good. And then I guess just in general, navigating the European venture scene, it sounds like almost all of this, you know, started from introductions, but any thoughts on tips of just raising money in Europe? You know, any advice you would give?
Yeah, so at the moment, there is a lot of money and a lot of opportunities, and great investors have raised, you know, big funds and are looking to invest. So there isn't any kind of liquidity issue right now in the market, especially early stage. Not that I see, and especially not in Europe. So the key is, it sounds tough, and I think a lot of kind of first-time entrepreneurs, especially if they never raised for their startup, are kind of a bit confused about how do you get around to getting introduced to investors. But it's not that difficult. I mean, at the end of the day, as I said, you have a product that the investors are really, really interested to know about. Their job is to find great companies and deploy as much capital as they can into this company. So don't be shy about asking for introductions and use your network. And if you don't have a network, build your network. And if you don't know how to do it, well, that's your first task as a founder, and you have many other challenges in the future. So it's not, nobody says it's easy. By the way, my first recommendation is do not start a company. Come and join my company. Sure. Because we need great people. And if you're really, really, really crazy and you still want to do it and you're not listening to my advice, then you should really not give up. And it's difficult to create your network. It's difficult to get introductions, but that's, I think, the best way to approach it, especially in the early stage.
I think that's good advice. And this is also a pattern I've heard on a lot of these interviews. I'll ask the founder where they kind of built that network. And a lot of them intentionally went to work at a startup, you know, that was on a growth trajectory, partly just to build the network before starting their own. So I think that's a longer term hack. But yeah, it's a good hack actually.
And here's a supporting evidence for what you just said. As I said, I sold my first startup to the Priceline Group, the Booking Holding Group, they call it now. The CEO of the group is an amazing person called Glenn Fogel. He's a legend actually in online travel. He's the one who bought Booking.com for not a lot of money. I think it was $100-something million. And this asset is worth north of $80 billion now as a part of the group, right? So he's, I would say, arguably the best M&A person in for sure in travel, but maybe in history. I'm not aware of all M&As that happened. I know Glenn because he came to meet us in my previous company where I was an employee, right? So I joined the startup as an employee. I met Glenn. We kept in touch. And then I called him when I was looking for investors in my startup. So just to support what you just said, I mean, if you don't have a network, a great way to build your network is join a company that has investors, and you can meet the investor. And a company like ours, we are very happy with people, you know, for employees to join the board meeting, present something. We do dinners where you know, people from the team are invited to meet the investors and the board members. It's a great way to build your network for sure.
Yeah, oh, that's great. Very good. All right. Well, I will let you get back to building Travel Perk. Anything you want to plug, promote, open job recs, discounts, deals, anything happening that you want to call attention to?
So I think it's a great service to your listeners. If they travel for work, they need to know about Travel Perk because we are a way better solution than whatever they have. So if you're listening to this and you're traveling for work, get in touch, travelperk.com, or send me an email, avi@travelperk.com. I'll be happy to talk to you.
avi@travelperk.com. And is this something relevant? I mean, could a startup with four people use it, or is it more enterprise? Yeah?
No, we actually are focused on small and medium-sized businesses. So startups are a great customer for us, and we are a great solution for them.
Yeah, that's cool. All right, this is great. Fun stuff. Congratulations on raising multiple rounds and the growth. 1,500 companies, pretty cool. So good stuff. We'll look for you after your next round. How's that sound?
Sounds good. Hopefully it will be more than 6 months from now because we need to focus on building.
Yeah, right. All right, sir. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Cheers. Bye. Have a nice day. Bye-bye.